of the welfare state. And in one of the readings by Robert Hicks, he mentions how the origins in the U.S. anyway, really in the post-Civil War pensions for Union Army veterans, U.S. Army veterans. And they only went to the victors, of course, even though the country was supposedly reunited. The pensions originally only went to, of course, the U.S. Army veterans. And as Hicks says, there was a good use of tax dollars. In the state of Mississippi, for example, I've read that in the year 1870, about 80% of the state government budget went for artificial limbs for war veterans. And so this started out this way, but politicians very quickly turned it into a political patronage machine, as they always do with everything. For example, it wasn't very long, very many years, where you did not have to have any kind of injury or disability to get funds from the government. All you had to do was be old and be a veteran. And Abe Lincoln's son, for example, spent the entire Civil War, the American Civil War, in school at Harvard University, fighting for good grades. And but in the last 3 months of the war, he was put into the Army, made an officer, and put on General Ulysses S. Grant's staff, far away from any danger, of course. And so for the rest of his life, he was a veteran, quote, a veteran. And so there were, eventually there became many millions of these veterans who saw no action, did no fighting, just happened to be enrolled in the Army for a while, but they qualified for pensions. And of course, with any government employee, if they're given a subsidy or a job, a government job, anything like that, it's usually worth more than just one vote. You know, a man who gets a government pension for being a veteran will make sure that his wife votes for the politicians that are responsible for voting for it, his voting age children, his brother, his sister, relatives, aunts and uncles, parents. And so each government job and each government grant of a subsidy of any kind is usually worth more than one vote to a politician. And so so this was quickly turned into a political patronage program, because what rules all political decision making is the doctrine of concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. That's how politicians always keep themselves in office, isn't it? To find a concentrated, which is to say a well-organized politically special interest group, and give them some of other people's money, some of taxpayers' money, and then but the taxpayers pay a bill that is maybe a couple of dollars more each for that particular program. And of course, when you multiply the number of programs by the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands, that adds up to the multi-trillion dollar budget that we have today. But that was the beginning of it. So the veterans, so-called, became the first big lobbying group for a larger welfare state and ever-increasing benefits to veterans. And that was the beginning of the military worship, sort of fascistic military worship that pervades America today. And that was the very beginning of it. And if you fast forward in history to the New Deal years, this really was the big birth of the welfare state of the New Deal years, the 1930s, especially with such things as Social Security. And so, but the political patronage aspect of it was dominant during the Roosevelt administration. There's a good book on this by Jim Couch and William Shugart, and that's spelled S-H-U-G-A-H-A-R-T, Shugart, and William and Jim Couch. It's called The Political Economy of the New Deal. And they did a statistical analysis of all the spending during the New Deal years to see where the spending went, who got the money, and so forth. And they came to the conclusion after this big, long statistical study that the overwhelming criterion, the main criterion, was who supported Franklin Roosevelt and who they wished to support Franklin Roosevelt in the next election. And so there are places like the Mississippi Delta, where poverty was by far the worst in the United States during the Great Depression, got relatively few dollars. But states like California, where Roosevelt's margin in the 1932 election was very slim, got orders of magnitude more per capita as a way of buying votes. And I can read you a couple of quotes from these. Here's one of the things that they write. This is a Couch and Shugart book. The states that gave Franklin Roosevelt larger percentages of a popular vote in 1932 were rewarded with significantly more federal aid than less supportive constituencies. A 1 percentage point increase in support of FDR in 1932 presidential election translated into nearly $300 in additional per capita federal aid from 1933 to 39. So for every 1 percentage point increase in the vote, they were rewarded by $300 per head in federal grants. And this was back in 1933. And so that would be worth many thousands of dollars per capita, per person today. One final quote from this book to drive home that point. It says, the distribution of the billions of dollars appropriated by Congress to prime the economic pump was guided less by considerations of economic need than by the forces of ordinary politics. The New Deal failed as a matter of economic policy because it was so successful in building a winning political coalition. And of course, it never could have succeeded in getting the U.S. economy out of the Great Depression because of the concept of opportunity cost, taking $1 billion out of the pockets of the taxpayers and giving it away to somebody else is just robbing Peter to pay Paul. It's depressing one part of the economy in order to stimulate a different part of the economy. Rearranging the chairs in the deck of the Titanic is one way to look at it. And so the welfare system from the very beginning was used for politics much more than achieving any real objective, reducing poverty and so forth. And as Higgs says in the article I put on the reading list, the linchpin of the whole system was Social Security. And it was called social insurance at the time, but of course it wasn't insurance. It has nothing to do with an insurance policy. Just think of any insurance policy that you might actually have, car insurance or health insurance. It doesn't insure anything. It's a transfer of income from people who work to people who do not work. And the supporters, though, of Social Security have always very adamantly, sometimes violently, insisted that it is not an income transfer program. And there's something fishy about that because it is so obviously and so blatantly an income transfer program from the working to the non-working. You have to wonder why they would be so adamant. And they really have. I've been at conferences and in where this is being discussed, where there were just violent arguments over this. It's like arguing with somebody about their religion, which I guess statism is the religion of some people. And so it was always an income transfer program, and it worked as a great Ponzi scheme for a while. And a Ponzi scheme is a sort of a crooked criminal scheme that Bernie Madoff went to jail for, where you get an original group of quote investors to put in some money, and you pay them very handsomely, but only contingent upon luring more and more people into it. So if you can lure, say, 10 people into this plan, the original one or two can make out very well. They can give you $1,000 and you can pay them a 20% return, $200 a year forever, as long as you keep getting more and more and more people into it. And so when the time this program started, there were about 11 people working for each retiree. So it was very easy to fund this program. But today there's about one person working, or even less than one person, to support every retiree in the United States. And at the same time, the baby boom generation is about to retire and is already retiring for the past couple of years. And so there's going to be an explosion in benefit payouts. And so the only way to get around that is sharply higher taxes or diminished benefits. Although some politicians hope that bringing in maybe 10 or 20 immigrants and forcing them to pay Social Security taxes will help also. And so, but we'll see how that will work out. And so the effect of this that economists have always been debating for many, many years is the question of what effect it has on savings, because there are some sophisticated looking economic models to explain it, but it's really common sense also. And the common sense is that if the government tells you they're going to give you a certain amount of income in your retirement, it's logical to think that a lot of people will save less on their own. Not none, necessarily, although a lot of people have foolishly saved nothing or next to nothing for their own retirement, but they'll save less. Now, that affects the entire economy, because savings fuels capital investment, and it's capital investment that is necessary for increased labor productivity. And it's increased labor productivity that causes wages to go up over time. And so because of the reduced savings, it makes credit less available and higher price. It puts upward pressure on interest rates over time. There will be less capital investment by entrepreneurs, therefore a slower productivity growth over time. And so what we mean by that is that wages that once we're growing 4 or 4.5% per year on average, year after year for decades, might only be growing 1 or 2% instead. They still might be growing over time, except for periods of recession or depression, but they're growing, but not as fast. And there have been endless debates over how big this negative savings effect is on Social Security. But debates are always sort of trivial, and they're based on arguments over statistical techniques, but we do know that it does have a negative effect on private savings, and therefore it depresses economic growth. Another effect of this program is it crowds out private efforts, not just personal saving of your own to take care of yourself in your old age, but it sends out the signal that we don't need to do anything to take care of our own parents or grandparents in their retirement. The government will take care of them. That's the message that a lot of people give. And so not only do people save less for their own retirement, but their children do. Their children save less to take care of their own parents in their retirement. And a good illustration of this topic is the short little article I put on the syllabus for tonight by a veteran book. Was a former student of mine, and who now is a finance guy and living in Houston. But he's written some articles over the years on HC.org. And in this one, he sort of tells a personal story of he's from Croatia, and he tells a personal story about living in a society that had little or no welfare benefits. It created a culture of where everyone understood. The parents understood that they have to teach their children to be responsible income earners and family members, and that as a good family member, you take care of each other, your brothers and your sisters and your parents. And so the parents sacrifice for you. I mean, a veteran tells a story of how his grandmother spent her entire life savings to put his father through medical school, which she did. And then, of course, the father understands that it's his duty to take care of his mother, which he certainly did in her old age. And so, but with Social Security, it breaks that bond. It breaks that bond in the minds of a lot of people who think that they no longer have to do as much or anything to keep that bond between the family members. And so it crowds out private efforts of all sorts. In fact, that's exactly what every aspect of a welfare state does. It tells people you don't need to educate your own children. The government will do it. You don't need to take care of your parents and grandparents in their old age. The government will do it. You don't need to take care of the poor people in your family. The single woman with several children is having a tough time feeding everybody. Don't worry about it. The government will take care of her. And so people withdraw from this, from the system of private charity and the civil society. And the government takes over more and more. And not only that, when a lot of private charities try to help in their communities, the welfare state bureaucrats give them a hard time. They show up and they insist that you pay thousands of dollars for a license. They insist that you spend all sorts of money for your facility, whatever kind of facility you have, feed the poor or whatever you're doing in your charitable endeavors. And so not only do they give people incentives to cut back on their own initiative to help poor people in their neighborhood or even their own family members, but they harass us when we try to with fines and penalties and regulations. And so, and that's the way government works. It's always and everywhere imperialistic and bureaucratic, and every government bureaucrat is a consummate empire builder and sees private charitable efforts as a threat. That's why a lot of the government-funded research on private charity is not too charitable. And it always criticizes it as inadequate, not enough, misguided, corrupt, and so forth. And so the social security system, of course, is bankrupt like so many other aspects of the welfare state. And money printing by the Fed, of course, is what keeps the whole system going. Another big part of the welfare state that came into being in the 1930s was minimum wage, maximum hour legislation. And there were Supreme Court cases about this in the 1930s. In the early 30s, the Supreme Court ruled minimum wage laws unconstitutional. But then after Roosevelt got several appointees to the court, eventually a different court ruled that they were constitutional. So we ended up with the minimum wage. And of course, the minimum wage was and is supported by unions, even though nobody who works for a union makes minimum wage. And part of the politics of this is that the minimum wage law is something that prices out of the market lower skilled labor that may be competitive with union workers. For example, if you have two relatively unskilled workers who can paint your house and will charge $5 an hour, two high school kids, let's say, and a unionized adult painter who makes $10 an hour. Well, you can hire two of the high school kids for $10 an hour or the more skilled, more experienced union person for $10 an hour. But if the government tells you you must pay the high school kids $8 an hour, then it costs you $16 to have to hire them and only $10 for the union guy. And so the obvious choice will be to hire the union guy and not hire the high school kids. So you will have priced them out of a job, you will price them out of work. And the unions were always behind that. The unions were also behind prohibiting teenage labor. It was not out of concern for the poor teenagers who were being abused by working and by learning good work habits, but they competed with unionized labor. And so the unions were also always behind female labor laws that prohibited women from working in certain areas. And they were still at this as late as the 1980s. There were the U.S. Department of Labor was enforcing laws that prohibited what they called homework, where women in places like the state of Vermont were investing in sewing machines and sewing ski caps and sweaters and things like that, gloves, and selling them to Kmart or the retail chains. And then the women were very happy. They were being paid a good wage. They could work at home. They didn't have to go anywhere. Didn't have to hire babysitters or anything like that. And here comes the U.S. Department of Labor putting them out of work. And at the insistence of labor unions who simply did not want competition for higher priced, higher cost unionized labor in the textile business. And so, but that was also spawned by the great growth of the welfare state in the 1930s. And then after World War II, something that was similar to what happened after the Civil War occurred, in that there was the GI Bill, the so-called GI Bill. And this eventually led to the politicization of higher education. This was the birth of political correctness in the universities, because what the GI Bill did was pay a federal subsidy to veterans so they could go to school, go to trade school or university or any kind of training of any kind to help them out that way. But in terms of the university, there were, at the beginning, in the early years, some universities who are crooked, corrupt. They set up sort of phony diploma mills, as they're called. And so the government responded by saying, well, in order to qualify for federal funds now, we have to have accreditation. And so they set up these accreditation academies. And so to this day, of course, every university has to be accredited if they want to get government funds by the government. And so what this means is that accreditation has evolved. It evolved from first being just an honest educational institution and not some sort of phony diploma mill. You know, give me $1,000 and I'll give you a piece of paper that says diploma on it. But all sorts of insistence that your curriculum be approved by the government and be of a kind the government would like. For example, there was a case that I read of the Westminster Theological Seminary, I believe it was in Missouri, state of Missouri. They did not ordain women in this church. It's not a part of their religion. And so when it came to get their accreditation, the government approved accreditation authorities told them that their curriculum was fine, but they did not approve of the fact that their religion did not allow them to ordain women. Therefore, they were not going to get them accreditation. And so this has been a major reason, in my view, of the politicization, a major way in which the politicization of higher education has taken place. And because after all, the old saying that he who takes the king's shilling becomes the king's man is as trite as it is true. You take government money, there's going to be some degree of government control of what you do and what you say. And I can't think of any place where that's more prevalent than higher education. And the GI Bill spawned all of that. But of course, another big element of the welfare state in the 1960s was the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which immediately, day one, became a program administered in a way that handed out racial preferences, even though the law makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, creed, or color. That's always exactly what the law has done in its enforcement, discriminate on the basis of race, creed, and color. And this sort of came to a head in the Supreme Court case when the University of California Medical School sued over the fact that he had a much higher entrance exam score than he was a white guy than some black students who had applied and were accepted. So the black students were accepted, but he was not. His name was Alan Baake, Baake, I believe is how he spelled his name. And the Supreme Court did rule in his favor, sort of, because he was discriminated against, and the Civil Rights Act rules supposedly outlawed discrimination, but they left a giant loophole in there. They said, however, if you call the discrimination diversity, it's okay. And so that's why, to this day, if you read about what's going on at the university, you would think that the sole purpose of higher education in America today is diversity. And so it's sort of salving a white liberal guilt about the failures of all their welfare programs to help minorities. And so they enforce a reverse discrimination with a vengeance in the university these days, not only hiring the faculty and staff, but also enrollment of students. And so the Civil Rights Act has always been enforced in exactly the opposite way that it was stated in the actual law. And the famous dictum by Martin Luther King Jr. that he would want someday to see his children and grandchildren judged not on the color of their skin, but on the content of their character. Well, this law was always the opposite of that from the very beginning. It was always based on judging people by giving out jobs based on skin color and not the content of their character, performance, achievement, and so forth. Another rather insidious thing the government did in the 1960s was to finance what they called community action programs. And what they did here, and this is where Obama came to be a community activist. The government actually funded, provided seed money for tens of thousands of private, supposedly private nonprofit organizations in many areas. Many of them call themselves anti-poverty organizations, civil rights organizations, environmental organizations, unions, and so forth. And they're given government money and to administer government programs. And so, you know, the American welfare state, very little of it is actually administered by the government itself. It's mostly administered by state and local governments, who in turn pass through some of the federal grant money to these various allegedly private nonprofit organizations, of which there are many thousands. And so these thousands of nonprofit organizations become lobbyists for higher taxes, bigger government, and bigger welfare state. James Bennett and I wrote a whole book about this almost 30 years ago now. It's called Destroying Democracy: How Government Funds Partisan Politics. And we had a very large database of federal grants to all these nonprofit organizations in just about every area of government. And we ran down, we did the research on what these organizations actually did with the grants. And it was basically lobbying for bigger government and higher taxes. And so the government actually pays itself to twist its own arm to become bigger, in a sense. And so when you hear, if you remember Obama defining himself when he came on the political scene as a community organizer, this is his world. Groups like ACORN were at the forefront. This ACORN is an acronym for Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now. If you've heard about ACORN or read anything about them. And Obama was a lawyer for ACORN when he got out of Harvard Law School. That's his claim to fame in politics. And so he was always involved in this community action network, which is basically a network that had voter registration drives, much of which are crooked and fraudulent, and basically lobbying for a bigger welfare state. And so that was another part of the welfare state. Then, of course, there's Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare and Medicaid came along. There's some very straightforward economics of the effects of Medicare and Medicaid. And the effects of Medicare and Medicaid is to tell two large segments of the population, the elderly, well, over 65 age group, and although I don't like the word elderly, there are a lot of people I know who are 65 or over who are much more vigorous than other people I know who are 50. And so 65 and over, and then Medicaid goes to lower income. And of course, that's an arbitrary definition by the government, lower income, if you qualify for Medicaid. So those two very large groups, tens of millions of people, face basically a zero price for medical care. And of course, principles of economics will tell you that when anybody faces a zero price for anything, then the consumer demand is going to be much higher than if there is a positive price. And so what Medicare and Medicaid do is to shoot the demand for medical care of all kinds through the roof. So there's a vast expansion of demand, but the supply of doctors and hospitals and nurses only increases relatively slowly. It takes a lot of time and a lot of money to build that many more new hospitals in a country as big as the U.S. Doctors have to go through many years of medical school, so it takes a long time to have a significant increase in the supply of medical services, however you might define medical services, because there are many different markets belonging to that definition. And so what Medicare and Medicaid did basically was cause a skyrocketing of demand with a relatively constant supply. And, of course, that means prices get shot up through the roof, through the ceiling, so to speak. And in any country that has done something like that, in order to control the escalating costs caused by the government program, they impose some sort of price control, a government mandate holding down the price. Now, in the United States, they don't call this price controls. They might call it budgeting, or some sort of adjective in front of budgeting, cost-effective budgeting or something like that. In the state of Maryland, they have, I think what it's called, the Maryland Healthcare Cost-Cutting Commission or something like that. And so they will use the coercive powers of government to mandate the prices that doctors and hospitals can charge as an attempt to impose price controls. And of course, whenever you impose price controls, you create shortages. And we haven't done this as much here in the United States as they've done in Canada and England and elsewhere. But you inevitably create shortages and a brain drain of people who, if we go down this road much further, like we appear to be in the United States, we're going to experience what the Canadians and the British did in a brain drain. People who go to medical school for many, many years, all of a sudden are told, we're going to pay you pretty close to what a bus driver makes. They're going to look to go somewhere else. They're going to look to Singapore or Taiwan anywhere where they can make a free market wage as opposed to a centrally planned and controlled wage, which the United States seems to be heading in the direction of. And so that was the effect of Medicare and Medicaid, sort of a mini nationalization of a portion of the healthcare market of America. And it caused an explosion of cost and price and government regulation to follow to futilely try to hold these prices down. And of course, the most heavily studied aspect of the welfare state has been the effect on work incentives. And the basic line of reasoning is that, for example, in some places like New York City, a single woman with two or three children who qualifies for welfare can make as much as, I think today, about $40,000 worth of cash and in-kind government benefits on welfare. You know, cash, for one thing, housing subsidies, daycare subsidies, food stamps, and so forth. So $40,000. You know, if she takes a job, say she gets an even a decent paying job, I don't know, $10 or $12 an hour, the more money you make, the more you become disqualified on a sort of a graduated scale for more and more welfare benefits. And so it differs state by state in the United States. But the research on this tells us that in some places, the implicit tax is about 70%. If you take that decent paying job, say she gets some training and education, the kids are in school, and so she can work, and she gets that $12 an hour job, $15 an hour job, she loses enough money that she's paying effectively a 70% income tax. So if she makes, say, $10 an hour for 40 hours, $400, she's gonna lose, $275 a week in government benefits, in some places. And so, most people will look at that and say, it's not worth it. It's not worth going to work, spending money on clothes, on food, on gasoline, on commuting, for what? For $125 a week, babysitting, daycare, and so people are trapped in the welfare. That's why you see generations of people on welfare, and that effect, that policy of having generations of people on welfare, is a good way to kill off the whole work ethic. The famous Protestant work ethic that older generations used to talk about and praise about America, that is largely gone. And of course, public housing was a big part of the American welfare state. And public housing is inevitably a disaster everywhere and anywhere, whether it's the Soviet Union or the American Union. And the basic reason is the absence of property rights. People who do not own property simply do not take as good a care of that property as people who do own the property. Because if you invest in it, if you invest in property maintenance and painting and everything like that, there's no way you could ever recoup your investment. You can't get back any of your investment because you don't own it, and therefore you can't sell it. And at the same time, if you damage the property or destroy the property or let it deteriorate, and the value goes down, it's no skin off your back. The government will simply pay somebody to give you a different apartment if it becomes crummy enough. And of course, a lot of the government housing projects have been blown up and raised by the government. Now, the government really crowded out the private housing market. I mentioned this last week when I mentioned the book by Martin Anderson called The Federal Bulldozer, where Martin Anderson wrote about how when the so-called urban renewal programs in the 1960s, the government came in and literally bulldozed entire neighborhoods of lower middle class, working class neighborhoods and displaced them with these awfully ugly institutionalized buildings that look like bomb shelters. They look like East Germany during the Cold War. And so they of course deteriorate very quickly because nobody has an incentive. The owners have no incentive. There's no manager who has an incentive to make sure that the public housing projects are clean and safe because there's no profit in it to anybody. So you eliminate the profit incentive from housing. You eliminate the incentive to improve quality as well as the incentive to hold down the cost. And that is exactly what has happened with the disastrous public housing, so-called, aspect of the welfare state. And by the way, that word public housing, public service, public goods is a very bad term to use because after all, every bagel shop, every coffee shop serves the public. It's not as though only the government serves the public, but that's what the message is. You know, we call it public housing. You know, why wouldn't you call the private housing market public? It serves the public. But the government has sort of absconded with this word to apply only to themselves, supposedly. I mentioned this article by Vedran Book on families. He has a great finishing line. He says, the death of the family is the health of the welfare state. And there certainly is a lot of truth to that, isn't it? That the death of the family is the health of the welfare state. The final thing I'd like to mention is the effect on children of the welfare state, which is why I put this article by Robert Rector from the Heritage Foundation on the reading list. Robert Rector has done a lot of very good work on the effects of the welfare state for a long time, about 25 years. His job at the Heritage Foundation in Washington has been on this. And he cites the work of an economist named June O'Neill, who was once an economist at the Office of Management and Budget and an academic, a professor. And she's done a lot of very interesting work on the welfare state and how it affects children in particular. And some of the effects on children, and especially on family breakup, is another of the big effects of the welfare state. And the nexus here, the connection here, is that the stigma of abandoning your children is lightened, if not abolished, by the welfare state. Men are told, if you abandon your children, someone will take care of them. 75 years ago, that was not true. You couldn't rely on somebody taking care of them, although the civil society was much more vigorous then, and you could rely on churches and charities and communities and neighbors and families to do this. But still, that's part of the stigma. There's a limit that still did exist, but it's been largely eliminated, which is why the so-called illegitimacy rate is so high in the United States. And it tends to be the highest in the groups, the ethnic groups in America that are the most heavily targeted for welfare benefits, quote, benefits by the state. And among the things June O'Neill and other researchers have found as far as the effects of children growing up without a father around, because of course these are generalizations. Everyone knows someone who grew up like this and has done just fine, and everyone knows people who grew up with family intact who's done not so fine, but these are generalizations. Social scientists deal in generalizations after all. As Hans Hoppe sometimes says in explaining this, he says, Germans like sauerkraut more than Italians, and Italians like spaghetti more than Germans do. However, it would not be hard to find a German who likes spaghetti more than he likes sauerkraut, and it would not be hard to find an Italian who likes sauerkraut more than he likes spaghetti. And so the fact that you can find one counterexample says nothing to a social scientist. These are generalizations. And so the generalizations that have come up from, we've learned from all the statistical research on the effects of how the welfare state and family breakup are lower IQ, very significantly. The longer The longer a family is on welfare, the lower are the children's IQs. Lower is the earnings of young men. The more ingrained the welfare state and the welfare state attitude is in their family, their parents, the more likely it is that they will have illegitimate children and continue the cycle. Okay, and with and also in general, children who grow up in these families on welfare where the father has abandoned or was never around in the first place have been found to have significantly higher emotional problems and are more prone to get involved in crime as teenagers. And so there are all sorts of negative pathologies that are created by the welfare state in children. And I do hope you have a chance to look at the one thing I put on the reading list was a video interview with Charles Murray about what he calls Little Platoons. And the Little Platoons is a chapter of his book, In Pursuit, which is my favorite Charles Murray book, In Pursuit. And the subtitle is Of Happiness and Good Government. And the Little Platoons are really the elements of the civil society that once existed that would help people out if they have problems with poor people in your neighborhood, a mother with several children that can't be fed, and so forth. And he talks about it in a very logical way and based with statistics to back up his argument about how the welfare state goes about crowding out these little platoons. And I also mentioned on the first class a book by Marvin Orlatsky called The Tragedy of American Compassion. And what Orlatsky does in that book is he traces through the meaning of the word compassion over about a 100-year period in the United States. And originally, compassion meant making some sort of sacrifice for others or suffering with others, not necessarily suffering, but making a sacrifice, donating some of your time, some of your money to help somebody out. That's what compassion meant. Eventually, it evolved to mean, do you support government programs to do these things that you used to be compelled to do or you used to be incentivized to do? In fact, just this morning, I read an editorial in my local newspaper by a long-winded editorial by a man criticizing and excoriating another letter writer who had criticized the welfare state, and his theme was, have you no compassion? And so that's the way Americans mostly think now, is compassion means, do you support all these failed government welfare programs? And it doesn't mean, have you made any personal sacrifice for the benefit of somebody else, as it used to be? And Marvin Orlatsky does a fascinating job in his book of tracing through the literature, the language of not only the popular press and books and magazines, but political speech over the past more than 100 years, I think, he goes back. And he sort of sees the 30s as a cutoff point, and especially the 60s, where this rhetoric of compassion really became, by the time you get to the 1970 or so, then compassion really meant, are you in favor of an explosion of a welfare state or not? If not, you're not a compassionate person. And that, of course, is why President George Bush, who I usually refer to as W, spelled V-U-B-Y-U-H, came up with this idea of compassionate conservatism. He never could speak in complete sentences, so it was hard. If you listen to him, it was always hard to figure out what the heck he was trying to say. But he did have some advisors, including Marvin Orlatsky, who tried to talk him into doing something about reversing this, at least this language about compassion. But of course, what Bush did was to set up programs that gave even more government money to church-related programs that were still out there doing private civil society charitable work. And so that corrupted the churches even more than they were already corrupted to begin with government money. For example, Catholic Charities, which is a gigantic charity, gets more than 50% of all its revenue from government. And as a result, it's very left-wing, very big supporter of the welfare state, and it is prohibited from trying to teach Catholicism or the principles of Catholicism to any of the people who it is trying to help who are in need of help with food or clothing or shelter or anything like that. As I said, you take the king's shilling and you become the king's man, and that's true of Catholic charities. And so the Bush administration actually did exactly the wrong thing in giving money to churches as a way of supposedly stimulating private charity, because the churches were no longer private once they accept government money. And so that's what I wanted to do tonight is to go over sort of a lot of topics, but mention a lot of points about sort of the way in which economists, and especially Austrian economists, think about the law of unintended consequences always and everywhere at work whenever you have big government programs like the welfare state. And of course, there are thousands of welfare state programs in the United States, literally thousands, and I've only mentioned a few of the bigger ones, like Social Security, minimum wage, and the AFDC, food stamps, things like that. And food stamps, by the way, is an interesting story. The origin of food stamps is it was a result of the government's price support programs in agriculture, whereby it was illegal to charge a price lower than a government prescribed price. And so the price of farm products was propped up artificially. And as a result, there were surpluses. The higher price, the farmers want to grow more food and raise more livestock, but the consumers don't want to buy that much because it's too pricey. So there are surpluses. So in an effort to get rid of the surpluses, the government came up with this idea in the 1940s of food stamps. Give low-income people free food. But the objective was never to reduce poverty at the beginning or to reduce hunger. It was to get rid of the agricultural surpluses created by the government's price support programs. I wrote about this with my co-author James Bennett in an old book of mine entitled Official Lies, How Washington Misleads Us. It was published way back in 1992. My co-author was James Bennett. And we wrote about the whole history of the food stamp program in there and how this was the genesis of it. It was sort of a bailout of the corporate farm lobby was the motivation for it. And I think I'll stop there. I've been going on about 45 minutes, but I wanted to touch upon some of these points about thinking about the unintended side effects and sometimes the intended side effects of welfare statism. And I'll do what I usually do, and I'll give it a shot to answer whatever questions anybody might have, if you have any. And there's no requirements. You don't have to ask questions, but of course, I'm glad to give it a try. Tim Malcolm is asking about conservative organizations that will fight the welfare state and not the warfare state. Well, that's certainly true. That's sort of a defining characteristic of a conservative, is to be sort of a warmonger. And I think one part of the problem is if you think of some of the organizations like the Heritage Foundation, that they got too close to the military-industrial complex. And they started taking too much money from the military-industrial complex, which I consider to be a part of the government. Any business or industry that gets its revenues from the government is a part of the government. And so they take all this money from Northrop Grumman and companies like that, and so they're not going to criticize the military-industrial complex. So they sold out, in other words. Now, that's why we have organizations like the Mises Institute that are more principled than some of these so-called think tanks that sound conservative but really have nothing to do or little to do with the old right. I think the genesis of that was the takeover of much more libertarian-oriented conservative movement in the 1950s by William F. Buckley Jr., the former CIA employee, and National Review magazine. And Buckley, Murray Rothbard quoted Buckley in an old magazine called Common Wheel magazine, and saying we need a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores to fight the Cold War. And so from the 1950s on, The major spokesmen of conservatism in America were basically warmongers, people who favored a big FBI, a big CIA, a big military, for the Cold War. And Buckley actually called it a totalitarian bureaucracy, you know, just like the Soviet Union had a totalitarian bureaucracy. And so today's neoconservatives are the spawn of Buckley, the totalitarian, self-described totalitarian, William F. Buckley Jr. And I guess some of the older ones, they've been spouting this line their whole lives, and so they're not about to change and say, sorry, I've been wrong for the past 50 years. That'll never happen. And also, they're part of the establishment. So if you want a career, if you're a younger person who's involved in this and you want a career, well, you can have it made. You can get, they'll arrange for you to have a cushy job at one of their think tanks. They'll put you on the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. They'll see to it you get a $200,000 advance on your next bad book that nobody reads, and on and on and on. They'll make you a radio talk show host, like a Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity, and you become very rich. You become a millionaire. But you can't criticize the military-industrial complex. You can make really minor criticisms on the edges, but you mostly bellyache about how it's not big enough. And so that's what that movement has become. And it displaced what is known as the old right. And Murray Rothbard was a key member of the old right. And so that's what people like Ron Paul have been trying to do, is to resurrect the old right ideas of limited government, meaning limiting the welfare state and the warfare state. Because we understand that war is the health of the state. There's an inherent contradiction between conservatives like Mark Levin, the radio blabbermouth, who pretends to be a constitutionalist, but he's also an inveterate warmonger. And nothing causes the state to grow more than war. And so you're a walking contradiction if you're a neocon warmonger who claims to be a constitutionalist at the same time. It's just a blatant contradiction, in my view. Kay is asking for disasters. Importation of unskilled laborers. No, that's not a disaster. Unskilled labor, there's nothing at all wrong with that, actually. I mean, a free market internationally for labor is a good thing, a free market. What the debate over immigration is mostly about, and should be about, I think, is that, well, how many of these people will become on welfare? It is possible. If you come into the country and you do enroll in welfare, you can bring 11, 12, 15, 20 members of your extended family with you, and they get on supplemental Social Security income. And they can be there forever. And so the potential is an explosion of the welfare state expenses if Americans open up their pocketbooks to the entire planet with an open-ended, open borders immigration policy and a welfare state. And it's not just libertarians who have been warning about this. It's other conservatives like the late Milton Friedman, Thomas Sowell, Walter Williams, Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize winning economist, Daniel Buchanan. And so it's been recognized for a long time. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. It doesn't work. That's a good thing. And raising the minimum wage always prices the least skilled and least educated people out of the job. And that's why the unions like it, because it prices out of a job potential competitors for union workers. And so they always like that. And it's a good idea not to call public education public, to call it government. And that's true of anything, government library, and so forth. Let's see, a question from the Mises Institute. Stockman said that the farm lobby log rolling played a big part in the rise of the welfare state. Well, James Bennett and I do document at least one part of it, of where the farm lobby was very happy to get food stamps. And so, yeah, that's one example that I would cite from my book, Official Lies. And, of course, the farm lobby, if it's a lobby, it log rolls. Now, all lobbyists log roll. You know, we will support your bill, even though it doesn't affect us, if you gather, you get your people together to support our bill when our bill comes up for a vote, even though our bill doesn't affect you. That's what log rolling is. And so, yes, that'll happen. Yeah, Bob is shocked. Yeah, the Cross Bronx Expressway. It looks like Dresden, Germany at the end of World War II. I've taken the train up from Manhattan to the Foundation for Economic Education in Irvington, New York. And in parts of that, you know, it's kind of a beautiful trip right along the Hudson River. But you go mile after mile after mile, closed down factories and decrepit, disgusting looking housing. Take the Amtrak train into Baltimore from New York, and you go, you know, mile after mile of unbelievably falling down public housing projects that are just hideously ugly. I know in Baltimore they shoot at the cops in the housing projects too. They're dangerous as well as ugly and broken down. It's all a result of the absence of property rights. That's what it's housing socialism in America is no more successful than housing socialism in the former Soviet Union. Let's see, Malcolm is talking about the central banks of the world sort of conspiring as a sort of a cartel to keep all of their welfare states going. But is there a differential? Well, you know, government bureaucrats are all inherently screw-ups. And so let's not believe that they're all wizards of Oz, that all the Ben Bernankes and all of his clones are wizards of Oz and can pull a few strings and push a few buttons and make the world economy hum to their tune. They can't. And so it's inevitable that some will, every one of them will be different in a lot of different ways. And there are a lot of different other aspects involving economic growth and entrepreneurship and technological development, apart from the effect of central banks. Look at for example, the former Soviet republics. Some of them have done much better than others. At the beginning of the end of the Cold War, Estonia did much better than many of the other Soviet republics did, because they relied more on markets. And so I still see a lot of difference in the world. some of the well-known financial advisors that are familiar with those of us who read Mises.org and LouRockwell.com see places like Singapore as much more promising than the United States in the future. They see even countries like Brazil finally coming out of its socialistic funk and becoming more capitalistic. Chile is more capitalistic than a lot of the other Latin American countries around it. So I see a lot of differences around there. And I don't see the central planners and the central bank being all that on top of things. And Bob is asking about the curricula becoming less strenuous. Well, that wasn't just because of the draft. That's because of the government policy of everyone needs to have a college education, just like the government policy of everyone needs to have a house. That created the housing bubble, and they've also created a higher education bubble. I can't predict when the higher education bubble is going to burst, but it has to burst. When you have mediocre schools like the one I teach at, Loyola University of Maryland, where it costs $50,000 a year for room, board, and tuition, that has to be a bubble. I don't know where these people come from that are willing to pay that kind of money for that kind of education. It's about the same as if your child went to Harvard. And so that has to burst. But I think just the general push to convince people that everybody needs a college education is behind that. Bob, I put a video on this week's reading list by, I think it's the interview with Charles Murray, and then I thought I'd put another one by The Tragedy of American Combat and Marvin Alasky on there. I'll have to look at it. I don't have it in front of me. I don't have the syllabus in front of me right now, but I'm pretty much sure I sent that in to Danny on the syllabus. If not, I'll put it up. Kay is asking, are we in danger of a tipping point? Yes, I think we're well on our way to maybe not third world status, but in the 70s, they were talking about the British disease because the British economy had nationalized so many industries, and their welfare state was one of the biggest in the world at the time, and it created what we're starting to see here in this country. I think if we haven't passed the tipping point, unemployment is still, the government claims it's 7% and is bragging about that, but that's still very high unemployment. And if you look at the way government used to calculate the unemployment rate, say during the Reagan years, the real unemployment rate would be more like double that. And so we still have a pretty bad economy. But the media doesn't cover that much because they like Obama. I'm not in favor of the Republicans either, but if it was a Republican, the media would be, every day they would be complaining. And they would have, pictures of old ladies eating dog food out of the trailer, in the economy and that sort of thing. But we still are doing pretty poorly economically. And I don't see anything changing around, aside from sort of cataclysmic events, the dropping of the dollar as a reserve currency by the rest of the world, for example. Anytime soon. Yeah, Malcolm makes a good point. Social work used to be very different. Now social workers are pretty much petty lobbyists for more money. There once was a much more of an emphasis on helping rather than lobbying. That's certainly true. I don't know when the change occurred. I would guess the 1960s was a big turning point. Yeah, Bob makes a good point. Yeah, some late union contracts, if the minimum wage goes up 10%, it gives the union leverage, for one thing, to bargain and say that, well, we're only making 10% more than minimum wage, so you should pay us more. And there are contracts that create a gap, a required gap between minimum wage and the union wage. That is true. I'm not sure how pervasive that is. But keep in mind, private sector unions are still only maybe 6 or 7 or 8% of the private sector workforce. Let's see, any more questions here? It looks like the gang is running out of gas, and that's okay. It's Sunday night. It's getting ready for a big meal before they fall asleep on the couch, watching Sunday night football, I guess. Some of the guys, anyway. Let's see. Kay wants to know, entry of women into the workforce was necessarily due to the fall and the drop of gold standard. Well, yeah, I think there is a connection there because the drop of the gold standard eliminated the discipline that once existed, much of the discipline on government spending once existed. And so the government started growing much faster as a result of that and therefore crowding out the private sector more and more, raising taxes more and more. And there are numerous reasons why more women enter the workforce as opposed to the home workforce. But one of them certainly is the necessity to earn enough income to pay all the bills. And of course, higher taxes and lower economic opportunity forced a lot of women into that that would otherwise not have chosen to work so much or to work at all. And of course, just the world changed. The world has changed. And that when I was in college, a business school class, an accounting class of say 30 students where I went to school, that might have had one or two women in it. But today, the women are the majority of students in accounting. I think they're the majority in law schools now. So the world has changed in terms of preferences of people and what they want to do with their lives. But also, there is a link between dropping the gold standard and the growth of government. And there's also a link between the growth of government and higher taxes and reduced economic opportunity that has forced many women, probably millions of American women, to work more in the formal workforce than they would like to, women with children, that is. And so, yes, so it's not a direct link, but I think the link is there. Economists did form some of the welfare state. Milton Friedman, even though he's known as conservative free market guy, he was famous for recommending a negative income tax, which is simply a cash subsidy to people on welfare. And he had it very carefully worked out whereas everyone understood, it's one thing to give people a cash subsidy, but you can't be too generous because if you're too generous, you will kill off the work incentive. And so he had all kinds of diagrams in some of his articles on the negative, so-called negative income tax, purporting to show sort of a tipping point where you're getting too generous with welfare payments and they're going to kill off the work incentives. And he was always a Republican Party advisor and Republican Party economist. And one of the things he did do was to advise the governments on how to go about administering an efficient welfare state, which is sort of a mockery because the welfare state is not run by ideological eunuchs. It's run by people who always think it has to be bigger and more generous, always and everywhere. So it was very naive of Friedman to think that something like that would be run by a robot, or to think that something like his monetary rule was feasible in a real world political regime of any kind. Yeah, well, a lot of economists also, Adrian is asking this question, a lot of economists are trained in mathematics and statistics, and they don't really think much. They're trained in techniques, and they have very, very small ideas. They don't think big ideas, and they don't read much either. They read journal articles. They're very narrowly trained, very technically trained, and very poorly read as a rule. There are exceptions, of course. The Austrian school is where 99% of the exceptions are, because there's always been a literary tradition in the Austrian school. But the mainstream, so-called, the tradition for a couple of generations now has been math, statistics, and becoming a more and more and more of a narrow expert in a more and more and more narrow subject area. And that's one of the things that always was attracted to the Austrians to me. They wanted to understand how the world works, not to show off how much math they think they know. And you can see how it's easy to get bogged down in statistical techniques, and I guess we could have a long conversation about the incentive that exists within academia too, which are always to publish a long list of very short articles that nobody reads. And so you can't become very well educated about the welfare state or anything else if that's what you spend your life doing, writing 5-page, highly technical, mathematical articles proving a minor point. You can spend your whole career learning very little doing that. Bob is asking me about the women in the workforce and meat and PCism. Well, I have no idea how to answer that question. Political correctness, there you go. I'm not sure. Yeah, Yeah, Kay is asking, economists, technicians without historical perspective. It's only the Austrians that study history of economic thought, for example. Hardly anybody in the economics profession studies the history of their own profession. And there is a subdiscipline of economic history, and the Austrians have done a lot. Mises and Rothbard, especially, and myself, have written a lot on economic history, using economic theory as our guide to understand world events and personalities. But that's not the technique that most professional economists use. They pick very narrow subjects or hypotheses, and they test them using statistical techniques, and they usually say very little. Maybe for the next class, I'll run down some of the titles or topics of some of the academic journal articles and some of the big journals like the Journal of Economic Theory or the American Economic Review to give you an idea of what these people are doing. And it's pathetic and comical for the most part. I think Joe Salerno actually wrote an article about this once, but I forget where it was, probably Mises.org. Just mentioning the titles of articles in economics journals, it would make anyone think, what the heck? What is that? What does that have to do with anything? That's why they were all clueless about the real estate bubble. And none of them, only the Austrians, predicted the real estate bubble. Ron Paul, Congressman Ron Paul, who was well-schooled in the Austrian school business cycle theory, was out there in the year 2002 predicting a bubble was going to burst. It didn't actually burst until 07 and 08, but Ron understood that the Fed was creating a bubble, but the mainstream was clueless. They'd even written books and articles about how clueless they were. Let's see, Malcolm is asking, there was a draft deferment. There was a draft deferment for married people. So a lot of people got married to keep out of the draft, including my older brother, who got married at age 21, primarily to keep out of the draft. And so there, I don't know how many millions did, but then that was ended. The government ended that. And there was also a college deferment. If you were enrolled in college, there was a debate over that because the argument was, well, the rich kids who can afford to go to college get out of the draft, but it's the poor kids who are forced to go and die in the Devil's War. And that was a darn good argument. And that argument ended that deferment. Okay, well, it looks like we're about out of gas then, I guess. Maybe I'll wrap it up for tonight then. And thank you all for participating. And hope you learned a few things and think in terms of Santa Claus and the welfare state. So, and I'll catch you next week.